Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello, welcome to The Gallery. Oliver Zahn is a German performance maker whose short working career has nonetheless resulted in a string of hauntingly simple and interminably thought-provoking artworks. In 2015, Zahn graduated in theatre and opera directing from the Bavarian Theatre Academy August Everding with a piece entitled Situation with an Outstretched Arm. In it, he examined the history of the legally banned Nazi salute in the form of a spoken word essay combined with an endurance act performed by actor Sara Tamburini. This was closely followed in 2016 by Situation with a Doppelganger, performed by Zahn himself with a black German performer, Julian Wagner, and constituting a historical and embodied exploration of popular and folk dancing, minstrel shows, and cultural appropriation. Once again, the format was an endurance performance accompanied by a spoken essay. This performance was shown at the postgraduate conference at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama in October 2018. In May 2020, Zahn was due to return to the UK and take part at the Gift Festival in Gateshead with his latest show, In Praise of Forgetting, in which he explores another controversial German topic, the oral cultures of the Germans expelled from the non-German lands following World War II. Due to the COVID pandemic, the Gift Festival took place online, and Zahn created a brand new offshoot performance, In Praise of Forgetting 2, designed specifically to be performed on Zoom and quickly becoming the festival favorite. In this interview, we find out the details of Zahn's artistic and intellectual journey and the processes of making these performance artworks. This conversation took place between Berlin and London on Zoom on the 28th of May, 2020.
Okay, well, thank you again for agreeing to do this. I saw, I experienced In Praise of Forgetting as part of Gift Festival. And also previously I'd seen Situation with a Doppelganger when it was on at Central. So the only one I was missing was your first piece, which thank you for sending me that. And also, obviously, there is In Praise of Forgetting Part 1, which I don't quite know what form it took in the actual performance. And we can maybe talk about that a little later. The main purpose of this conversation is to try and understand how your particular idiom as an artist has developed and how you've developed this way of working and this particular methodology and this particular interest in making theatre and performance in the way that you do. With the artists who we are interviewing, we try and revisit your formative steps, where you trained, how you reacted against the training you received, what other formative influences were present in your development as an artist and in the development of your methodology, your intellectual approach, and your particular aesthetic. I just watched Situation with Outstretched Arm, and from it, I can infer that this was possibly your student piece. Was it a student piece of yours?
Yes. Right. Yes. So was Doppelganger, actually.
So was Doppelganger, too. Okay, very interesting. So do you want to tell us about where you studied, what you studied, how you chose, maybe even if we rewind a bit further back, how you chose to study whatever you studied that led you to making this work?
Okay, so I studied directing for opera and straight theater at the Bavarian Theatre Academy, which is a very classical director's course. And it's the only one in Germany that does both opera and regular theater, Sprechtheater in German. I did not have any connection to opera at all when I applied for that. I kind of came to the whole idea of theater in a somewhat roundabout way because I grew up in a pretty rural area in southwest Germany, and there was no theater basically there. So I didn't really have any connection to that growing up. I did eventually start making like short films while I was at school. And from there, I kind of like after graduating, which was in 2009, that's when I really started getting into theater. And so coming from like a amateur filmmaking background, applying for a directing course seemed to make the most sense. Mm-hmm. At that point, I didn't know about like any of the like other courses, even in the German-speaking area that I could have taken that would have taken me closer to like a performance art context right away, you know, like Gießen and Hildesheim, if you know it, like the more experimental schools. So, which is why I basically applied for regular directing courses and got accepted in Munich. And basically, it was a very classical course that did have some freedom in developing your work, but I had a very turbulent relationship with the school, which included like me having like a burnout in the third, like it's a 4-year course. I had like a burnout in the third year and took like a year off. That basically came from me trying to make theater the way that the school, which prepares people to make work in state theaters, me trying to make theater the way the school and the state theater system wanted me to make theater. Mm-hmm. And I kind of really wasn't able to do that at all.
Could you illustrate that a little bit for us? How does a director train in a German academy context?
It depends. It's different from school to school because obviously I would say that there is no fixed way to become a theater director, right? So I would say that every school is different. In a way, I would say that I was quite lucky that I got to that school because there was a sense of, okay, there is no set way of doing things. I think that other schools are way more rigid than the school that I went to. So we had acting, singing, piano, choreography classes. We had theater, history of theater and opera, dramaturgy classes. We did a lot of workshops, collaboration with the stage design class at our school and the dramaturgy class. And from the beginning, we kind of always had these shorter, becoming bigger and bigger, like own pieces alongside that. And then obviously like directing courses, which kind of consisted of working on concepts based on plays mostly, and sort of like staging scenes with actors and so on and so forth. Very hands-on practical thing, which for me, like we did have a bunch of theory courses or seminars, but for me, like the theory part was like, I mean, I was the only one who thought that there wasn't enough theory. Usually the complaint was that people wanted to have more practical opportunities. Also, like in addition, it expected us to prepare the works that we were doing in our free time, basically. And so the idea was that at the end of the first year, you would do like a short 20-minute piece to kind of prove that whatever. Then the second year, you would do another piece. And then in the third and fourth year, you would do 3 pieces. Mm-hmm. The fourth year being completely free of anything else. Mm-hmm. So like you wouldn't have any courses in the fourth year. Now, basically, I completed the third year. I had my burnout during like that big production where I was basically, or let myself be convinced to do like a regular theater piece.
A play text.
Yeah.
Which one did you do?
It was Attempts on Her Life by Martin Krimp.
Interesting.
Which is not a bad piece, right? But I kind of just overdid it and didn't get to a point where I was like happy with it and just kind of like, burned out, basically. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the course was very accepting of that. And then I took 2 semesters off. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that I did was basically not do any theater at all and basically question whether this was actually what I wanted to do, if this was what it meant to do theater. But I realized pretty quickly that like I was interested in the performing arts, but I was interested in a different kind of performing arts. And so what I ended up doing in this in that year, after taking like 2 or 3 months like really off, is like I went to attend courses at the university in Munich, do like sociology and philosophy and gender studies, and just like get input basically. And I started working at various festivals, worked at Spielart in Munich and at Theater der Welt, which happens every three years. And so I kind of started like getting into the whole like touring theater performance experimental art scene more. And then I came back and did my last two pieces within the framework of the school, which was Situation with Outstretched Arm and Situation with Doppelgänger. But there is kind of like this very big break. Like I didn't really get anything done at all in those first 3 years. Then I took a year of break, and then I came back and did something that I'm still happy with now.
Great. And what was the impetus? Did you conceive of those pieces as companion pieces from the start? Or did you make one and then think of the other?
So it wasn't thought of as a duology at first. So I was only thinking about Situation with Outstretched Arm. I had the idea for that during the year that I had taken off. I'm very interested in history and memory politics and orality, obviously. And I have to reconstruct it, but I think there were some like new scandals by Jonathan Mese at the time. And I kind of became interested in this gesture in itself. And then it, like the first thing that was there was like the idea of like doing it, like doing the gesture for as long as possible, kind of like a very like classical, you know, like endurance art thing. That was something that I was interested in. But when I started researching, that's when I realized that the history of the gesture is actually very closely tied to the way that art and politics interact with each other. And that was basically the point where I realized that it had to be like two, like a double deconstruction, basically, like a deconstruction of the signifier, of the body, the gesture or the posture, and then of the symbol and its history. I mean, obviously there is like, you know, this whole Marina Abramović body endurance art thing behind that, which I was kind of interested in because it's obviously also what you're exposed to if you get like a very cursory overview of like the history of performance art and theater. So that it's that was something that I was interested in. I had seen the 12 Rooms exhibition. Do you know it? It was, I think it premiered as 11 Rooms at the Manchester Festival.
Yes, with
Marina. Art exhibition.
That's
exactly
right.
And there was this exactly, there was this one thing, there's this one performance of hers where she does the
she's sitting on the bicycle seat, right?
Exactly. So that was for sure something that I had in mind. And other kinds of endurance work that I was really interested in at the time. And then the other, I would say, big influence at the time for me was more coming out of film than theater, which was like essay films by Harun Farrokhi, for example, if you know him. He passed away a couple of years ago, but he's a very like influential German documentary filmmaker who did these like very interesting film essays in the 70s and 80s mostly, and kind of switched over into a more fine arts context in the late 90s and 2000s. That was something that I was quite interested in at the time. Those were influences that were, I guess, like important to me at the time, and kind of from the basis of what would eventually become a Situation with Outstretched Arm. It was interesting insofar as it's a piece that was created very, I mean, basically there was an idea and that was there pretty quickly. And in the first rehearsal, we could do a run through, right?
Yes.
So it was a very interesting way of rehearsing, which differed a lot from what I had been taught that rehearsal should be like, which was very cathartic for me in a way. So I basically just assembled a very, very small team of people that I really wanted to work with, which led to a big fight again with the school, because they expect you to work with a stage designer, to work with a dramaturg, to work with like the whole apparatus of theater production. And I didn't want to do any of that. And so I ended up having to do more work because I didn't want people to do that work, even though, you know, it's like an empty stage and I wrote the text myself and so on. I also have to say that, I mean, I knew that the topic and the form and the way that these two elements kind of interacted with each other was something that I was very interested in, but I didn't know why at that time. I know that better now, having done several pieces and kind of like realizing what where my interests lie and why. But at that time, I think it was very, it was still very much based on intuition, even though it's a very, very intellectual piece, not in, like not as a way of saying it's good or bad, but just the way that it works.
So you wrote the script, you worked with a performer, and you presumably had another performer who recorded the voice.
Yes.
Okay. And then the performance was, as you say, ready in the first rehearsal in a way,
I mean, I developed the text during the rehearsals still. I did like the preparation, the research beforehand, but the text was very explicitly written so that it would work with the action on stage.
Yes.
So I would always kind of like write like a new chapter and then try it out with kind of like where the bits are that kind of click with what you see at the time.
The performer in it, would that have been an actor training at your academy, or did you have a performer that came from a different training context?
She was actually an actor at her, like an acting student. So what I did is I tried it out myself at first, which is very interesting because like I had and still have this huge block in my head of not being able to do this particular gesture, which is something that I found very intriguing. And so I basically closed the curtains and closed all the doors and blinds and stuff, and then stood in front of a mirror and tried it out myself to see how long I could do it and whether it was even like viable as a something that would happen in the context of theater.
Yeah.
But I realized pretty quickly that when I do it, it's very much the image that you have in mind when you think of the gesture, because of me being like a German man, a white German man. And so I decided pretty quickly that I couldn't, didn't want to do it myself. So I basically asked everyone that I knew whether they could do it for me. And I did like a lot of like research rehearsals with like basically with like 30 different people. And I also tried out whether it makes sense to have several people doing it at once, which was very interesting, but not what I was looking for eventually. And Sarah, who is doing the performance, was actually the first person that I asked. And she ended up being the person doing the performance because for several reasons. One is that it's a very phallic gesture. It works very differently when she does it, I think. And the other thing is that she just automatically basically did it with the right attitude, I would say, because it's very easy in that case to, especially with the whole disembodied voice thing, for the performer to slip into this position of a victim. And I always felt that she had a way of doing it that was more playful and more of a way of seeing it as a physical challenge.
Yes.
She does yoga a lot, and so she's like very used to these kind of endurance things, I would say.
As far as actors go, she seemed very comfortable with being herself on stage. Yeah. You know,
she had a very similar story. Like she had also like a lot of trouble with the school, which is why I was kind of interested in her in the first place. Like she's not the typical actor that this school produces, I would say.
Right, interesting.
So I would say that she's very much an exception.
Diese Körperhaltung ist das Thema dieser Arbeit. Der Titel der Arbeit lautet Situation mit ausgestrecktem Arm. Das ist die Anordnung der Arbeit. Eine Stimme, diese Stimme, und ein Körper im Raum. Dieser Körper, Sarah, der diese Position einnimmt. Sehen wir uns diese Position genau an.
Conceptually, then, how did Doppelganger come about? This seems interesting to me that actually both pieces are in a way potentially dealing with controversial topics in German theater, right? So the outstretched arm and the blackfacing, right?
Exactly. So the very simple thing was basically, okay, now I've basically dealt with Nazi imagery. It was kind of like a bit after the last big blackface scandals in German theater. And so I was kind of interested to deal with another controversial symbol, I would say. But when I started researching it, I pretty quickly became convinced that, like, unlike the Nazi salute, I don't think there's any merit to putting blackface on stage right now in the society that we live in. But I also realized that the minstrel show, which was obviously where blackface comes from, is very interesting and very, very complex, very interesting topic that merits discussion and that is so influential to contemporary pop culture that it's like, especially in German discourse, it's just this like big hole in social memory. So I was kind of getting more and more into basically the history of minstrel shows, in these kinds of things. And Julian is actually someone that I knew from a bar in Munich where he was working as barkeeper and also doing like, it's this very cool bar that does like lectures and film screenings and stuff. And he did this series of lectures on Black popular culture in Germany. And so I kind of just talked to him about the piece at some point and about recommendations and like what books to read and stuff. And he basically gave me a list of like 50 books that I should definitely read. And it became clear pretty quickly that it would just make sense for us to do the work together.
What's the bar called?
Favorite Bar.
Okay, great. And what was Julian's background? What was it that led him to do these lectures?
I think he studied theater studies in Munich and he does like a lot of music and he's now doing his PhD in cultural anthropology. Yeah, and basically just ended up in Munich for studies and had just like this incredible like knowledge, especially also of like the German relationship to minstrel shows, whereas most of the material that I could find was very closely tied to the American minstrel show.
Right.
And so we basically joined forces. Mm-hmm. Julian hadn't worked in theater before, but had done like music stuff and some performance art, I think. And yeah, we originally wanted to work as director and dramaturg with a cast of performers, and then it became just became more and more evident as things progressed that it only makes sense to do this if we put our own bodies on the line, basically. We were thinking about the way that we wanted to work with the topic in terms of the form, and at some point we decided that since we're doing a piece about imitation and appropriation, we could also just imitate the form of the previous piece that I did and also imitate the title in a way.
Great.
Because the thing is that for the situation with outstretched arm, I thought about the title for a long time because I didn't want to put Nazi salute into the title, because the whole point is obviously to trace the various names and meanings and the way that it kind of solidified into the Nazi salute. And so I basically came up with this whole weird construct of situation with outstretched arm. And One thing that bothered me about it is that everyone just called it situation. So I thought maybe let's just give them another situation so that they can just abbreviate it like that.
Yeah.
So that was just like a bit of like trolling. But So there was this explicit idea of basically like copying my previous form for this new piece. It was also a productive way of dealing with our own incompetence in a way, right? Because we built ourselves like a framework that allowed us to concentrate on just the dancing, because that was hard enough as it was, right?
Yeah.
It's also very much developed out of the decision to perform ourselves, because we just wouldn't have been able to do anything else.
So the situation with the outstretched arm is in its form, one performer on stage holding their arm stretched out as a Nazi salute, while a voice is giving a series of sort of historical vignettes, descriptions of particular moments from the history of art where a similar gesture is featured, and kind of giving a history of that gesture. The endurance element is that for the duration of the piece, obviously the piece lasts about 40 minutes, the performer is tested, their endurance is tested throughout this piece. The situation with the doppelganger is a bit more complex because, well, it's a similar form in that you have a disembodied voice, as you've just called it, giving us a kind of essay about the history of minstrel shows. But I remember that there was a visual element there as well.
It's interesting because a lot of people think that about both pieces.
Right, interesting.
Yeah.
I was quite convinced that there was some sort of a PowerPoint going on.
But there is text. Like there is a
just text.
Yeah, there is a it says like there's like chapter titles.
Right. Yeah, I noticed that with this performance I just watched more recently.
Yeah.
And you and Julian are basically a white man and a black man dancing exactly. together.
What Doing are those same things at all times? Yeah.
Same things at all times, but there are moments of difference.
The rules that we dance by are exactly the same, but the way that we dance the different choreographies is very different because our bodies are very different. There's one dance, which is a couple dance originally, but other than that, it's basically...
there is an endurance element to this as well.
Yes, it's an indirect reenactment of a dancing competition in the 19th century between a black man and a white man about who was the better black dancer, mm-hmm. like a white minstrel performer and a black minstrel performer. And we were intrigued by this idea of the precarity of that setup and also the absurdity of it, obviously. So that's kind of like the frame, like the narrative frame that we work in, right? And so it becomes kind of this the dancing marathon as well, because it's about an hour long, the piece, and we, except for very short breaks that we take, like in between the chapters, I think it's 10 chapters, we're basically dancing the whole time and very physically demanding. We're doing like German folk dances, we're twerking, we're doing something that resembles an Irish jig.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing the dance from the music video of Thriller by Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing the cakewalk, which is a historical minstrel dance.
And the notion of reenactment here is sort of based on research again that you have done, but also to some extent it's a reconstruction of what it might have been in
yes.
the 19th century.
Yeah.
And you were entirely self-taught in terms of dancing? Or did you have some sort of choreography?
We had a coach, basically. Okay. So a good friend of mine, Quindel Orton, she's an Australian dancer based in Munich, who's just an amazing dancer, who was kind enough to teach us. So what we would do is usually our rehearsal days would be like I would write text in the morning, then we would meet up in a rehearsal space in the afternoon and work with the new text that I had written and the kinetic material that we already had, and then in the evening we would have like 1 or 2 hours of Quinn where she would basically teach us the dances that we wanted to dance. All the dances that we're performing in the piece are in some way recorded on video.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there is this element of reconstruction, obviously, especially for the dances that are from like 1830.
Mm-hmm.
But especially the older dances, they were all popular enough to still be around at the time where film was invented.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there are very short video clips of those dances that you can find when you know where to look.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we based a reconstruction on that mostly, but also on images and descriptions and scores. And the piece is different from like classical dance reconstruction pieces in that it doesn't claim to be the thing itself, right? It doesn't claim to replicate the exact choreography of a specific performance at a specific place in time. The way we get around that is by presenting a dance and comparing our performance of the dance to a different historical performance of the dance that happens somewhere else with different people and probably with a different set of exact movements.
Great. So then what was your next step?
There were like a bunch of like smaller things, and then there was another big piece called Zweiter Versuch über das Turnen, Second Essay on Gymnastics, which is like the next big piece, which is also what we basically founded Hauptaktion for. Because like from my perspective, the image or the concept of being a director that I was taught at school is a very, I would say, conservative image of the director, right? And so I wasn't very comfortable with that. And after graduating, I kind of looked for more collective ways of working.
Mm-hmm.
At first. The second essay in gymnastics was basically the culmination of that. We kind of did like we were a group of 8 people, the core of which was like Julian, me, and Hannah, which was another dramaturg who worked on the piece together, along with Quinn as well. And that was kind of like a big piece with like 9 people on stage tracing the history of German citizenship, I would say, through the lens of mass gymnastics, starting today and like going back all the way to when gymnastics, as we know today, was invented. So that was like something that took up a lot of time. And also it's kind of like the impetus, like I was really not interested in this classic position of the director, but I also realized in that piece, great as it was, that I also wasn't interested in this now also classical way of like collective work, you know, like Forest Entertainment, Gob Squad, mm-hmm. this generation of companies. That was also not something that I was interested in. And after that piece, it more or less naturally, we all kind of went our separate ways. And it kind of took a while for the company name that we had set up for the piece also to be
dissolved.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And we kind of retrospectively called everything before that Hauptaktion, which is why some of the reviews and things that you can find online are still under that name. But so now we're all like scattered in the wind doing our own thing, but also still collaborating from time to time. And then I did some more like smaller work and research stuff and soul searching. Then the next big piece was In Praise of Forgetting Part 1, which premiered last December, which was the first time that I was on stage solo. So mm-hmm. it's me performing it. And it's me interacting with the same archive that can be seen in Praise of Forgetting 2. But what I have on stage with me is the physical archive, or a copy. I made a copy of the physical archive, which consists of 1,239 magnetic tapes set up as a tower of tapes, which is like 2.5 meters tall. And then the piece itself, which also deals with forgetting as a social practice, is basically me interviewing that archive. So on stage, this tower of tapes and me were basically equal performers of the piece. And it's me asking questions to the archive, pulling out tapes from that tower and playing those tapes in answer to the questions that I ask, with the tower obviously eventually collapsing and scaring everyone in the audience.
Can you say a few words about what the original archive was?
It's an ethnographic archive that consists of the voices of hundreds of German refugees and expellees from after World War II. Obviously, Germany lost a lot of territory after World War II, especially territory that had always been contested between Germany and Poland. And Germany has a long history of, I would say, colonizing Eastern Europe. So there were about 12 million people who thought of themselves as German, or were actually German citizens, ended up after World War II in geographical areas that were not Germany anymore, or who had already been the German minority in different countries that were now being expelled after the crimes of the Nazi regime, which basically meant that then Western Germany and Eastern Germany had to, within 3 or 4 years, accept around 12 million new people. It's kind of a topic that is very touchy, I would say, because historically it's obviously very closely tied to questions of revisionism, especially in like before 1968, of like conservative and right-wing politicians still claiming ownership of parts of Czechoslovakia at that point, parts of Poland. And it's very closely tied to a self-image of Germans as the victims of Hitler, which was very prevalent in the years after the war. And it's also touchy because there used to be a large overlap in the personnel of the associations of German refugees with like right-wing, like extreme right-wing parties and organizations. So it's a very, I mean, you can see how, or you can hear how carefully I try to talk about it. Yeah.
I was just wondering where this archive was that and how you accessed it.
It's in Freiburg, which is in southwest Germany, like all the way in the southwest, almost on the French border. There's an institute called, in German, it's called Institut für Volkskunde der Deutschen des östlichen Europa, which went through a lot of name changes. But right now, I mean, the literal translation would be Institute for Anthropology of the Germans of Eastern Europe, basically. And the archive was made by the founder of that institute over a period of around 50 years. It was continued after his death in the late 80s by his wife and his successors in the institute that he had founded. And this person was also a very problematic character with a Nazi past and so on and so forth. But what he did is that right after World War II, he went around with a tape recorder, like a mobile tape recorder at that point, still very new in a way. And he went into the refugee camps and later into the refugee settlements and talked with the different people, because he realized that with all these people having to abandon their social structures that they had grown up in would also mean that a lot of like dialects and practices and songs and stories would be lost. And so he went around and tried to record them for posterity.
What was his name?
Johannes Künzig. At the start, this was still at a point where the idea that Germany would accept its new Eastern border was still very much up in the air in the 50s and 60s. So it's a very complex history of this archive as well. I kind of stumbled over it by accident, actually. I was looking for a different project. I was kind of looking for folk songs And the German Folk Song Archive is also in Freiburg. And I just ended up Googling folk songs in Freiburg and going through the results and kind of stumbling across this archive. And my grandparents are ex-police or were ex-police from Eastern Europe, along with basically, I would say that like around a quarter of the German population has this family background, but it's not something that is a relevant category today. And so that was actually what intrigued me. Like I went to Freiburg for this folk song archive and ended up going there as well. And that this was like 4 or 5 years ago.
So you found a personal connection there in an indirect way because of your own grandparents.
Yeah, exactly. The thing that kind of struck me was that there was this whole, this material memory of a generation that was supposed to be transmitted to me. Like it would, like the whole, like all these songs, that just the archive itself was made to preserve this knowledge for future generations. And I was kind of interested in the fact that that hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. Right? Like having dealt a lot with memory politics and historiography, I kind of became very interested in like the notion of forgetting as something productive as well, because obviously the academic discourse around memory politics is in a very different place than the discourse in the arts, I feel, or at least in the performing arts, certainly in the German speaking area. And so I became quite interested in this idea of forgetting, but and I also had been interested in this archive and in this topic for a while, but I was never able to find a way of thinking about it that I found productive, because I didn't think that it was a blank spot that needed to be filled or something. It wasn't something that I would have been able to talk about in the context of like memory or like counter history or filling in the blanks or something like that. That wasn't something that would have worked. And at the same time, in order to think about forgetting in a concrete way and not an abstract way, I was always kind of like lacking a thing to kind of analyze or to kind of examine that would work as an example of forgetting as something positive. Because obviously most of the time when you talk about history in a context of theater, and especially theater that has this progressive experimental self-image in a way, it's mostly about histories that are forgotten but shouldn't be, right?
Right.
And that's mostly what I've been doing as well, right? To think about the relations between the American minstrel show and German colonial past. I did a piece in an anthropological museum in Munich, a smaller one. The whole gymnastics thing was a way of retelling German history. But that kind of didn't work with like none of these discourses that I was usually like drawn to work with this notion of forgetting. And so at some point I realized that like, those two elements were actually made for each other, right? That this problematic discourse that was very fascinated by kind of allowed me to talk about forgetting as a positive, and forgetting allowed me to talk about this discourse in a way that avoided kind of the pitfalls of this topic, the reactionary provocation that comes with dealing with this topic on a German stage.
Very interesting. And so you said you made a copy of that archive. You like made, yes, a physical copy of all the tapes.
Yeah.
Which you use in your performance. Was that a problem in terms of like obtaining permissions to do that? Or
I mean, the people at the archive, at the institute, they were very cooperative. The person in charge of the archive, Elisabeth Fende, was just very, very helpful from the start. She's just an amazing person. And Werner Metzger, who's the head of the institute, was also very, very cooperative and basically cleared all like the bureaucratic hurdles for me, because the archive officially falls under the jurisdiction of the State Ministry of the Interior, and he had to talk to them to obtain clearance for me to copy it and everything. So it was kind of like it was a lot of back and forth between like different institutions, and it took a couple of months. The whole rights situation is very complex in any case. So yeah, it was a very, very tricky negotiation, but eventually it kind of worked out
And what are the kinds of questions that you use in your interview of the archive?
I thought a lot about the way to talk about this subject at all, like and how to structure it, how to talk about it, like whether to talk about it chronologically, whether to talk about it like topic by topic. And I ultimately decided that I would go with the most honest way of doing it, which was by structuring it along the questions that I had asked the archive, right? To just think about like any interaction with an archive as not like me finding something in the archive, but me asking the archive something and the archive answering something.
Yes. Right?
The things that I will find in the archive are obviously very closely tied to the questions that I can come up with, or the terms that I can come up with to find things that I'm interested in, right? So I thought that would be the most honest and effective way would to just take that like implicit process, which happened at my desktop with the register list and at the archive, like at the institute in Freiburg, with me going through, like they have like these big
catalogs.
Catalogs and
with cards,
hundreds and hundreds of cards, and registers.
So is it a game of some kind? Is it a game structure that applies then? Like, to what extent is it a script that you follow, and to what extent is it an improvisation with the archive?
Well, I mean, the questions that I ask are scripted. Having come to that point, to the point where I decided that I would structure it along my own interest, along the questions that I had, which kind of started with like, why were there Germans in Eastern Europe? How did they get there? How long have they been there for? To how did they leave? How was their reception? How were they remembered? And so on, right? Like really kind of like structure it alongside those broad questions. But it's a scripted text, right? So it's I know the questions that I'm asking, and I know the answers that I'm getting, because I'm obviously pulling out the tapes from the tower. But at the same time, so that is very much fixed. But at the same time, I'm basically playing Jenga with the archive, right? Mm-hmm. So I have this gigantic tower, which weighs like a ton and is 2.5 meters tall. And I'm pulling out tapes all the time to create new structures and maps and stuff on the stage. And eventually, like the tower kind of starts shaking and swaying after a while. And then at some point, obviously, it collapses. So it does have this game element to it, which all my pieces kind of have this chaotic element in a way, because I feel that the way that I work in general is that I make these very, very precise and very, very fixed concepts, and I need some kind of disturbance in that. Yeah, exactly. Like, for it to work, there needs to be this kind of like chaos element.
Yes. The tapes are mostly songs, or are there actual interviews in there too?
There's also interviews, it's mainly songs, some stories and descriptions of practices and rituals and stuff, religious practices and so on, but also like accounts of how they left their houses and how they came to Germany. But it's very interesting which topics the archive has a lot to say about and where it's silent as well.
What was that discovery? What did you discover in that respect?
I mean, it has a lot to say about German culture in Eastern Europe, and it also has a lot to say about the expilation itself, like the song, for example, that I'm using in Praise of Forgetting Part 2. But after that, like it doesn't have a lot to say about the process of integrating 12 million people. It doesn't have to say a lot about the non-German side of things, of the whole process. It doesn't have to say anything about Nazis mm-hmm. or about Hitler or about mm-hmm. German deportations of Polish people or of Jewish people from Germany. So there's like a lot of gaps in there.
And how do you deal with those in your piece?
Well, sometimes the archive doesn't answer. The whole interview structure allows me to ask like a suggestive question.
Yeah.
And have the archive be silent because it doesn't have anything in it. It's also very closely, it's a West German archive, right? It has almost nothing to say about the 4 million German expellees who ended up in what became the GDR. It's a West German archive of mostly those 8 million people who ended up in West Germany, as opposed to the 12 million in total.
Fern der Heimat ihr als Flüchtling, in der Fremde ich umher, und die meisten meiner Lieben, ach, ich find sie nimmer mehr. Dort, wo Ehrenfelder rauschen, dort, ja, dort war ich zu Haus, wo die Theiß in die Donau schlängelt, steht mein liebes Vaterhaus. Alle Lieben, die dort wohnten, alle sind zerstreut im Wind, keiner weiß, wo sie geblieben, ob sie noch am Leben sind. Freudlos ist mein ganzes Leben, seit ich in der Fremde bin. Keiner mag mich hier verstehen, fühlst, dass ich ein Flüchtling bin.
In Praise of Forgetting 2 came about as a result of the lockdown, right?
Kind of.
When you were approached to actually take part in GIFT, were you going to be bringing part one to the original festival?
No, actually, no. So I was supposed to have another premiere a month ago called Futur Germania, which is a performative museum of performativity, I would say. Which is going to be, I mean, it's probably going to be a couple of months before it eventually premieres, which is going to be, I mean, it kind of works like Chinese Whispers. So there's like in each performance, a new person encounters an existing set of performative artifacts and then manipulates that.
What are the performative artifacts?
Well, it's anything that is the thing itself while being performed. Like it could be a dance or a song or mm-hmm, a story, but it couldn't be a reenactment or a scene that represents something.
Okay.
And then the point is, it's basically a list of those artifacts. And the first part of the performance is the performer from the last show performing the current version of the show. And the second part of the show is a new person editing, curating that archive, some things out, bringing new things in, adapting things and so on. And then in the next show, being the first person to present the current version of the exhibition or museum.
That How was many people? What I was,
always two. I almost only do solos in a way. And even the pieces where there's more than one person on stage, they're still kind of solos, right? I mean, Doppelgänger is just like a copied solo. And the gymnastics piece that I did has 8 people on stage, but they're also moving in synchronization the whole time. It's one old person and one new person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the role kind of changes. So you're always first the new person and then the old person in the next show, which would have been nice, obviously, because we would have brought someone from Germany to Gateshead to be the first person. And then we would have had someone else come in, edit the archive, and then travel with us to the next. Next show, right?
Which so actually it's multiple people that are doing this.
It's always a new person. It kind of works like a Wikipedia page.
Great.
with new people coming in and editing it, and they're somehow ending up being this kind of a consensus based thing. And which is obviously exactly what it's exactly what you can't do right now, right? Meeting and traveling. The premiere was obviously postponed, and the shows that we would have played are also going to happen probably sometime next year. Then Kate Craddock, curator of GIFT, asked whether I would be interested in doing something online.
Mm-hmm.
Because they decided to shift the whole program of the festival into a digital space, which I found really interesting. But at the same time, I mean, I'm not sure what the situation in the UK is, but in Germany, there was right after the lockdown, people started streaming like crazy, and everyone did these weird adaptations of their work online, and all the theaters put old recordings of shows on their websites, and there was just this absolute overload of content. I always had this feeling of band-aids, things that you do, but that are only valid for a couple of weeks, and when the pandemic is over at some point, hopefully, they're not valid anymore. As soon as you have a way of gathering and performing theater again. So I was kind of very interested, because I'm at a point in my practice anyway where I'm really curious about things that transcend theater, the context of theater. I'm very, very interested in certain questions and topics and discourses more than in the building that they happen in, I would say. I'm quite curious to work on live art that isn't necessarily theater. I'm quite interested in exploring other forms. So I was quite intrigued, but also a bit cautious, I would say. And we first talked about the first suggestion was whether there's anything about Futur Germania, the other, the piece that we were originally supposed to show there, that we could have done online. But with that piece, I'm pretty certain that that wouldn't work. But the thing is that the whole archive that I used for In Praise of Forgetting Part 1 exists as a digital conversion. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mostly used to make the piece, obviously. I didn't, for every bit, put the magnetic tapes on the recorder and, look through it. I mainly did it on my desktop. But that's not something that the stage piece necessarily deals with in any detail. It doesn't not appear in there, but it's not, the main focus. When I was working with a dramaturg on the piece and last summer, and we did talk about whether it makes more sense to put the physical archive on stage or whether to do a desktop performance. So that was something that we talked about, and something that I had thought about several times actually in the past years, but never, there was never an opportunity. And for the stage piece as well, we pretty quickly decided that it makes a lot more sense to put the physical tapes in the physical space as an equal to me. But there was kind of this interest in the digital archive and also in the form of the desktop piece. And there's obviously like a whole discourse about forgetting and the internet that does not happen in the original piece because it doesn't happen on the internet, right?
And did you still collaborate with a dramaturg on this new piece?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's the same one, actually. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the first thing after I talked to Kate about doing something and after deciding that if I was going to do something, it would have to be connected to In Praise of Forgetting, we also talked about whether it makes sense to do like an adaptation or a continuation. I wasn't happy at all with the idea of doing an adaptation precisely because after the lockdown is over, it wouldn't be valid anymore. Like there wouldn't be a reason to play the digital adaptation of a piece that I'm very happy with as a stage performance when there's no need for it anymore. And so I wanted to do something that kind of stands on its own and is right exactly the way it is, no matter what the context is.
Yes. And so you conceived this second piece as being an investigation of archiving and forgetting digitally. And there was only one song that you focus on from the original archive, if I remember, yes. And some kind of footage around that. What was also very interesting was that there was this live commentary going on from you in text boxes on your desktop that mm-hmm. the audience could see. And that was the main means of relating or driving the actual content of the piece mm-hmm. In its live form. Was there any precedent that you were aware of in this way that, you know, that you were kind of thinking about when you were considering how to do a digital performance based on this mm-hmm. material?
Yes and no. Like the thing is, I've never actually seen a desktop performance before. But
when you say desktop performance, you are referring to something that kind of maybe exists as a genre, or
yeah. Like so, there's a Brussels-based choreographer called Brianna Fritz who did a desktop performance a couple of years ago, which I haven't actually seen, but which I hear is very, very good. And then obviously there's, I think, piece from 2004 by Edith Kaldor, where mm-hmm. she also only acts on her computer, which is projected on a screen. Like I do feel that especially if you like leave the sphere of theater and performance art and go into a more live art, net art context, then it's much more common than in theater. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I would definitely say that it's like nothing, like the form is nothing new at all. And I'm very aware of, I would say, the genealogy that I'm kind of like putting myself in. And at the same time, the pieces that I'm aware of, I haven't actually seen. So,
okay. That's probably advantageous in some ways as well. And so what's interesting about that piece, In Praise of Forgetting Too, is the way in which actually, except for the song, all of it unfolds in silence. Hmm. So there is no orality or aurality associated with it, but actually there is maybe something we can think of in terms of digital orality, in terms of the way in which you are actually having a conversation with the audience through the text boxes that you're using. And you have made work that you've referred to as essay performances mm-hmm. because there is this element of the...
Yeah.
Kind of giving information to the audience in a structured way through the voice that's pre-recorded. So I'm just trying to think about how this element of sharing information with the audience manifests itself in this latest performance, but without the oral and aural element.
Yeah, a friend of mine would say that my work is very much based on like pointing at things and saying what it is.
Right.
Or what they are.
Yes.
Which is also about why I'm, for example, like very interested in guided tours and just the idea for the commentary, right? I mean, I would say that the main tool that I'm using is that commentary in various forms. That is in a way what I'm also doing here. I mean, one main reason why I ended up working only with written text, I mean, is obviously because it creates an interesting contrast with using the song and having the song as the only point of reference. But it's also, I mean, it's also very much born out of two things. One is very, very current in that there's obviously this very specific aesthetic of the pandemic, right? Which is what we're looking at right now, which is faces in front of bookshelves and somewhat grainy audio, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And that's something that I really wanted to avoid. I mean, I was interested in the idea of doing a performance on the desktop before, but the fact that just the omnipresence of like this image of the face in front of the bookshelf is like one of the reasons that really pushed me towards like not using any recorded imagery at all, and also kind of pushed me away from like using any kind of audible commentary. And the other thing is that I'm always looking for the strongest possible form. Strong not in terms of quality, but in terms of rigidness, I would say, which just kind of pushed me also in that direction. And then I would say that it's not only a desktop performance, because I know that, for example, in the Edith Kaldor performance, she performs the piece on her desktop, but the desktop is projected onto a screen, I think. And I think that for this piece, it's very important to watch it on your computer screen, because the impression that you get, which is that things happen on your computer screen, this kind of like hauntedness of your computer screen, I think is very important for the piece and creates a kind of intimacy that I wouldn't be able to create while talking. By not saying anything, it also creates this impression of like almost as if your screen had been hacked, like as if your computer had been hacked.
Right.
It's like things happening on your like the way that you experience a virus on your computer is also like, you know, like windows popping up, advertising popping up, and so on, right? It's kind of silent.
This is a very banal question I've had ever since I've seen the performance. I was really wondering what would a score for a performance like that look like? I mean, how did you memorize the protocol?
I mean, it's a mixture of rehearsal and probably things that only I can understand when looking at the text. I mean, I did like the text. Do I have it here somewhere? It is kind of written in a way. Like there's like a lot of like line breaks and dot, dot, dots and like little arrows and stuff, which I can kind of, which for me kind of signify that like here I have to delete something and rewrite it and stuff.
I see. So it's, you know, it's so, all encoded in that
yeah,
way.
So like certain cues are in the text.
Yeah.
Like especially like if whether something happens in a new box or whether it's something is like erased or inserted in somewhere, that's kind of like in the text. But then the placement and rhythm and stuff is kind of just through practice. And obviously now I have videos of it and can kind of rehearse with that when I
Amazing. Yeah, that's really interesting. The rhythm of it kind of is linked to the actual video documentation.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the other thing is I did perform it a week and a half ago in German, in a German theater. And obviously I had to translate it and adapt it a bit. The rhythm is very closely tied to grammar and language, right? Because the German language obviously works differently from English. And so it creates kind of like a different rhythm.
Right. So you conceived it in English, but you then translated it into a different way. Very interesting. And what's next?
I mean, I'm going to perform In Praise of Forgetting Part 2 a bunch of times now. Because...
Because it's so appropriate. What you described, you know, was exactly my experience. Yeah. I saw a lot of live stream performances and then I saw this piece and it was like, yeah, this is...
I just want to be seeing pieces like this now. I don't want to see any live stream theater.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of accidentally fell into this gap in what people were looking for. And so I'm going to, there's actually quite a bit of like interest from festivals. So I'm going to be performing that. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, I have a premiere. I'm supposed to have a premiere in December, but who knows what happens in December. It's supposed to be here in Berlin at the Hau. It's called Necrologues. Basically, it's a start of like a what is supposed to be like a longer running series of eulogies. It's not one piece, but it's a collection of short eulogies in different formats. The idea is to start with 6 necrologues in December and then kind of just basically keep working. It's more a practice than it is a piece, I would say. Mm-hmm. But obviously right now it's still a bit unclear under what conditions we can play in December. So I might actually end up doing, I mean, this is at the start, at least supposed to be like a theater practice mm-hmm. with the option of it expanding into other mm-hmm. formats as well, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. why can't it be a film or something else, right? But yeah, it's kind of like part of my trying to like get out of this whole logic of the project, right?
Yeah.
And more into a logic of kind of like ongoing practices that yield different results. The original idea was to like kind of start with it being like performance theater based and then expanding into different formats. And I mean, I might have to kind of like flip that around and start with formats that can be shown anyway, even if it's online. But at the same time, I feel like that with In Praise of Forgetting Part 2, I've also kind of set myself like a standard for what I consider to be valid online art for myself, for my own practice. And so I kind of wouldn't want to kind of fall below that. So depending on how the pandemic develops, there might either be like some more online content in the fall or a big premiere in December.
So thank you so much. That's really, really rich and stimulating. Lots to think about. And
I hope it wasn't too rambly.
No, it was perfect. It was really perfect. And I love the idea of commentary, actually. I haven't thought about this being commentary, that particular term, but you're absolutely right. That's what it is. And when you say guided tours, you're interested in, have you made a piece in that form yet?
I have. Uh-huh. A couple of years ago also. And then it kind of like dropped.
What was that called? And what was it about? What was it a guided tour to?
It was a guided tour through the Oceania exhibition of the Anthropological Museum in Munich.
Okay.
It's kind of a longer story, but I got a research grant from Goethe Institute together with a British artist who's mostly a singer, Phoebe Wright-Spinks. And we went to Papua New Guinea to kind of look at the remnants and continuations of the colonial past of that particular country, because it used to be... the part that we went to used to be a German colony and then came under British control after World War I and then into Australian control. And so we kind of looked at that and we talked to people and visited sites and so on. But we also went into the different museums there and documented that and then kind of came back into, like came to Germany. We're also joined by Julian at that point, my doppelganger collaborator. And then we did like as a three people team kind of did a guided tour through that museum after it closed. And then the first part is kind of like a guided tour through the exhibition. But what is being described is not what you see, but what is being described are like rooms in museums in Papua New Guinea. Then the audience is kind of like directed through the archive of the museum to kind of see all the things that didn't make it into the exhibition. And it kind of became this piece about like, yeah, how to write history and how to curate history. That's also something that I'm really interested in, that I've been interested in for a long time. That kind of, I did like another shorter piece with Phoebe before that, which is also kind of guided tour based, which is also very much kind of like a researchy, like both of them are kind of like not weren't finished pieces, but like these kind of like quick, yeah, scratch works basically. And that's actually something that I'm looking to pursue more in the future.
Great.
Like the idea of the guided tour.
Just going back to the beginning of our conversation, when you were talking about how you had this formal education as a theater director, and then all of your work since then has been more in the category of live art and those theoretical issues that come up in, you know, performance theory, those problems of historiography and so on. And all of that has basically been something that you have kind of pursued entirely on your own and after. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.